The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Trending in the wrong direction. Today, in a Russian-controlled part of eastern Ukraine, shelling and an evacuation order.
Of course, that creates mass panic, and they are already packing their things.
Many think Russia wants an excuse to invade. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, many years ago, U.S. sailors stationed in the port of Barcelona introduced Franco-era Spain to some key bits of American culture.
They bring in the first Zippos, rock and roll records, jeans.
Leading to one of Barcelona's biggest industries. And take a deep breath and say the new name for Bangkok.
Gruntep Mahanakon, Amon Ratanakosin, Mahin Tarayutia.
You might need more air. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Welcome to the show on this Friday. More reports today of new clashes in eastern Ukraine between Russian-backed troops and Ukrainian forces. U.S. officials have been warning of a possible Russian invasion into Ukraine any day now. Russian diplomats have responded with denials. President Biden plans to speak again this afternoon about the latest developments in Ukraine. For a perspective from inside the country, I spoke earlier with Maria Avdieva. She's research director at the Ukraine-based European Expert Association and based in Kharkiv, the city in eastern Ukraine near the Russian border.
Well, we see a very worrying trend right now. Since yesterday, there was a major escalation going on. And the aim of that escalation, which is apparently led by Moscow and Moscow-controlled proxies, is to show that Ukraine is planning some kind of offensive against the occupied territories, which is completely untrue. And the Ukrainian commander-in-chief made today an official statement that Ukraine is not planning any kind of offensive, and the militias are deliberately misleading people and using them to escalate.
Yeah, that's the suspicion that a lot of people have been repeating. Let's unpack that bit by bit, because overnight, rockets were flying in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. We've seen the damage to a kindergarten. Who is doing the shelling?
The shelling is done from the territory controlled by the occupational forces. But what do? They disseminate disinformation through the Kremlin-controlled sources, saying that it is Ukrainian side doing these shellings. And that also creates the atmosphere of panic and fear among the population that lives on the occupied territories.
Let's just drill down on that a bit. Today, the head of the Russian-backed separatist forces in Ukraine announced this evacuation of his region of eastern Ukraine to places, safe places in Russia.
В первую очередь, эвакуации подлежат женщины, дети и люди пожилого возраста.
I mean, it's unclear whether or not his announcement can be taken seriously. Some are also calling it part of a false flag operation, with the implication that an evacuation means serious fighting is about to begin. How are people in eastern Ukraine and in government-controlled territories reacting to this announcement?
Well, for the people in the areas controlled by the Russian proxies, of course, that creates mass panic, and they are already packing their things and preparing for that evacuation. But we try to give them information that this kind of activities could be used for some kind of provocation against the civilians.
I mean, in contrast with the possible false flag operation by the Kremlin, Moscow has also made several announcements this week of troop withdrawals. What do you make of that, Maria?
Well, our military intelligence says that it doesn't see any signs of major troop withdrawals. So they did withdraw some small amounts of troops and showed videos, but it doesn't influence anything because other troops came into that place again. And so Russian troops are basically now surrounding Ukraine from the three sides.
Maria, as I said, you're in Kharkiv, a city close to the border with Russia. What is the feeling there today?
People are ready to fight because we are living in the situation of the ongoing aggression for 8 years already. And to the other hand, we really appreciate the support from our Western allies, especially the United States. People follow all the planes carrying here the defensive weapons because they understand that that could help the Ukraine survive. They also give us the feeling that Ukraine is not alone and the people, they are not afraid. But of course, the feeling that the major escalation is very close, that gives the overall influence on everyone.
Maria Avdieva is Research Director of the European Expert Association. She joined us from Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine. Maria, thank you for speaking with us. Be safe.
Thank you very much.
It's been 6 months since the U.S. launched an all-out push to evacuate Afghan citizens from Afghanistan ahead of the U.S. troop withdrawal. More than 70,000 Afghans are now resettled in cities across the U.S. Many, though, are still separated from family members scattered around the world. From Tucson, Arizona, Elisa Resnick brings us a story of one family trying to reunite.
On a recent video call to Turkey, Ahmad Naim Wakili's daughter didn't recognize him.
She don't know me, who I am. It was very difficult for me.
She's two, with a mop of curly hair and big blue-green eyes like her mom. He has an album full of pictures of them on his phone.
He's my daughter.
Oh my goodness, she's so cute.
She was 15 months.
But he hasn't seen them in almost a year. Wakili is an Afghan refugee who landed in Tucson last year after being evacuated from his country in August. He was an assistant judge there in a court at the Bagram Air Base outside Kabul, where he adjudicated terrorism cases involving ISIS fighters, Al-Qaeda members, and the Taliban. The work almost killed him. A rocket hit his car a few years back. Weeks before he was evacuated, he survived a shooting attack that left him with one kidney. Photos taken during his recovery show him lying in a hospital bed with a blue, bruised face and eyes swollen shut.
This was almost 3 years ago.
It was a different attack.
Yeah, the attack by rocket.
Attacks like those are why Wakili asked his wife to live outside Afghanistan a few years ago. He says his work at the airbase meant it just wasn't safe for her there. She gave birth to their daughter in Turkey. Now, the two of them are stuck there. A mountain of U.S. government paperwork stands in the way of their journey to reunite with Wakili in Tucson.
Somewhere in here I've got the full package, but it's like pages and pages long.
Steve Kozacik is a Tucson City Council member. We're looking through emails on his computer about Wakili's case. After they met last October, Kozacik asked Wakili to swear him into office.
Here's a guy who's an Afghan refugee. He's been here for 2 months. He's already participating in our democratic process. And found out about his wife and daughter still stuck in Turkey, and so we said, let's get him reunited.
Since then, Kozacik has reached out to agencies across the U.S. to get Wakili's wife and daughter to Tucson. It hasn't happened yet.
Congressional offices, the senator's office, State Department, the only piece of good news is they're on a list.
Wakili applied to get them here on humanitarian parole. It's an emergency immigration status the Department of Homeland Security grants to people who need to come to the U.S. immediately. It's the same status he and other Afghans were granted automatically after the evacuation. But he submitted applications for his wife and daughter twice. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, has rejected them.
There is never an answer.
One avenue for Afghans is a special immigrant visa. It's a status given to people who worked with the U.S. government and suffered serious harm as a result. But even though Wakili worked alongside the U.S. military at the Bagram Air Base, he was employed by the Afghan government, so he's not eligible. His humanitarian parole status will expire in 2 years. Sunil Varghese is with the refugee advocacy agency International Refugee Assistance Project.
After that date, the person might be in the U.S. without any sort of lawful immigration status and required to go back to Afghanistan. And right now, the U.S. doesn't have a plan other than having all those people apply for asylum.
That's what Tucson immigration attorney Maurice Goldman is trying to get for Wakili.
This case is probably the strongest asylum claim I've seen in my 20 years.
He hopes that process will help get Wakili's wife and daughter here, too. He says USCIS is reviewing their humanitarian parole applications again. A spokesperson with the agency said since last July, they've received more than 43,000 humanitarian parole requests from Afghans alone. They're used to getting less than 2,000 requests a year. Just 170 have been accepted so far, and some 1,500 have already been denied. It's a grim reality Wakili knows well.
I'm in U.S. My brother and sister, they're in Pakistan. My mother and father there in Afghanistan, and my wife and daughter there in Turkey. It's one family.
He keeps a photo of him and his wife taken in Turkey last year. They're standing in the airport with their arms around each other before he boards his plane back to Afghanistan. It was the last time they saw each other. He says he doesn't mind where they end up. Arizona, California, any other state. They just need to be there, together. For The World, I'm Alisa Resnick in Tucson, Arizona.
It feels like old news, but not for Italy. Survivors of child sexual abuse by Catholic clergy there are calling for an independent investigation. Independent inquiries into the church's handling of abuse claims have already been carried out in Australia, France, Ireland, and the U.S., but in Rome, near where the Pope is based at the Vatican, such an investigation has yet to be launched. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry is on the line. What have we heard from child abuse survivors in Italy, Orla?
Well, a collective of essentially 9 separate groups came together in Italy this week, and they launched this campaign called Beyond the Great Silence, where they appealed for both an independent inquiry into the scale of sexual abuse by members of the Catholic Church in Italy, and they also called on the Italian government to bring about tougher laws to bring paedophile priests to justice. Often prosecutors in Italy have said that their hands are tied because of an expired statute of limitations, and survivors groups say, you know, they want this to change, and they also want to see an independent inquiry that goes back decades, because in recent months, as you mentioned, in France and also in Germany, there have been national inquiries. There are also upcoming inquiries in Spain and Portugal, and campaign groups in Italy say, look, it's time for a similar inquiry to be handled here, but it must be an independent one. And the church in Italy is saying, well, we can conduct an internal inquiry into it. And survivors groups are saying, no, that's not going to work. One of the survivors this week, Antonio Messina, he recounted how he'd been repeatedly abused by a seminarian when he was a child. And that man, he made the point, went on to become a priest. And when he went to the church authorities about it, his silence was bought, was as he put it. And he said, look, because of my experience with the church, I just don't believe that the Catholic Church is capable of handling an internal investigation like this. It has to be an independent one.
And why has a proper inquiry into this not happened yet in Italy?
I think there's a couple of factors here. There is the role of the Vatican, naturally, the seat of the Catholic Church being based in Rome, and that's influenced how the Italian Church has dealt with the crisis. But also, the Italian government itself bears a big responsibility for this. I spoke to Claire Giangrave, she's Vatican reporter for Religion News Service in Rome, this afternoon about this question.
The Italian government isn't just that interested in pursuing these cases. A lot of the success in countries where the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church has been firmly addressed, not just in the media, but also in courts and in legal proceedings, comes from this joint effort to really address the problem. In Italy, there's been a sort of failure to launch. You have small organizations really like raising their voice. You have some media outlets picking it up. But on the other side, the government and the church have been slow to respond.
Finally, Orla, what have you seen from the majority Catholic Italian public on this issue?
Yeah, I think there's real mixed feelings about this. I mean, campaigners said this week they felt that they don't really have the support either from the church or from the government, or indeed in some cases from the general public. I mean, we have seen church numbers in Italy falling like they have in most parts of Western Europe after the allegations of abuse came to light. But there is a sense from talking to people in Italy today that the kind of push that you saw in the media in Boston or in Ireland to really investigate how the church has handled this in Italy, and this could affect the appetite for an inquiry. I mean, one journalist was saying to me earlier that state media often tends to be pretty reverential when it comes to the Catholic Church and the Vatican. And if you don't have the local media giving the sort of coverage we might have seen in other countries and, you know, recounting the cases of abuse and the effect of it, etc., you don't have the same public outrage. If you don't have the outrage, you don't have the same pressure on politicians to do something about it. And they said one, you know, maybe good thing is the fact that the international news media is covering this, and perhaps the pressure from international media will put pressure on local media to cover it a little bit more, and this might have a more of an effect on the general public and bring more pressure on the government to do something about it.
Orla Barry, The World's Europe correspondent, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use WISE, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. WISE has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. WISE is designed by international people for international people. Try WISE for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Before COVID, tuberculosis was the most deadly infectious disease on the planet. In 2020 alone, it killed about 1.5 million people, and it is on the rise. Just think about that for a moment. Indian journalist Vidya Krishnan spent a decade researching TB for her new book, Phantom Plague: How Tuberculosis Shaped History. She chronicles how TB has been a major force in the evolution of medicine and public health, and how it underscores how global inequity actually fuels new pandemics. Vidya Krishnan joins us from Goa, India. TB is a very old disease, used to be associated with vampires, and when it was misunderstood and it simply ravaged the body, consumed the body, it was known as consumption. One historical lesson you write about is how TB helped some European scientists, a few famous ones like Louis Pasteur. It helped them understand infectious disease and really changed the way medicine is practiced. Can you explain how TB became like this breakthrough disease in terms of medicine at large?
TB used to be considered, it was not an infectious disease because people believed in something called the miasmatic theory, that diseases spread by foul smells, which is how malaria gets its name from medieval Italian name for bad smell. And people thought TB ran in families because people living in close quarters would have it. So people thought it was hereditary. People did not understand that if you did not wash your hands, hand hygiene was important if we had to contain infectious diseases. I mean, they sound basic now in 2022, but these are hard-earned gains that were made, and it traumatized scientists. And I profile this one particular scientist who died a very miserable life because he faced science denialism his entire life. And I kind of wanted to chart how hard people work to gain the understanding that we now take for granted. TB was a brutal killer, and we are unfortunately back at a time where, again, like 200 years ago, doctors just helplessly watched as patients die. And that's what's happening now with drug-resistant TB, with all the fruits of modern medicine. Antibiotics don't work on the newer strains of TB. And we also have newer strains of COVID. And everything that happens in the book has come to pass in the last 3 years. And it's been frustrating to watch that.
Well, I'd love to get to what understanding we have now that we didn't have, say, in the 18th and 19th centuries, when in the U.S., for example, in New York and other major cities where TB was killing thousands of people, the first public health campaigns kind of arose. New York, as you found out, passed a ban on spitting in public to try to stem the spread of TB.
New York had a very interesting litigation about how men were upset when asked to stop spitting by the health department, even in the face of a ravaging TB outbreak. So all of this was also spreading TB. And instead of stopping to spit, men wanted women to not wear long skirts because, you know, these long trailing skirts, which was known as the septic skirt, because it would take the spit from the road into the house. And that's how men said that if you care so much about not spreading it, wear shorter skirts. And the hemlines rose. And the minute the hemlines rose, shoes became fashionable. So I also kind of go into how societies change around pandemics.
A septic skirt, what a concept. So Vidya, today around the world, spitting still happens. And yes, I do see a lot in the U.S., maybe even more surprisingly during the pandemic. If these habits continue today around the globe, how are different countries dealing with this lack of hygiene?
So Mumbai has a very serious crisis. India, I work in Bangladesh, I work in India. Southeast Asia has a very serious TB crisis, and not coincidentally, very serious spitting problem. So that's actually the reason why I went into how New York grappled with legislating this behavior. Because I do believe Mumbai, which I focus in the book for quite a bit, is a very big hotspot for the global TB epidemic. And yet you see people carelessly spitting and, you know, not covering their cough or sneezes. Thankfully, because of COVID, in some places, people wear masks now.
Yeah, so India generally, as you say, has the world's most TB cases. It's also where there are some of the worst inequities in treatment and access to new medicines. Talk about that.
That is correct. India is one of those countries where in a 5-kilometer radius, you will see sub-Saharan poverty as well as the same lifestyle that you'd have in London, Paris, or New York. And all of it kind of comes back to how the rich in India actually do have access to better healthcare. But the poor who have to go into government hospitals face a very cruel medical apartheid where they are either undertreated and without compassion. The rich also have a version of this where they are overtreated because of their insurance. And I'm sure this is familiar for the US as well. And what all of this does is patients are either undertreated or they are overtreated with antibiotics. And it's resulting in mass medical negligence, which is then resulting in a very serious crisis of drug resistance, which for now is concentrated in Mumbai. But as we know from coronavirus, a small, you know, a pathogen in Wuhan just engulfed the world. And that's exactly what's going to happen to these concentrated clusters of outbreaks. They will boomerang out if we don't urgently address them. And that's the conversation this book intended to force.
Vidya, what changes would you like to see so that all TB patients globally get treatment and get this disease under control?
One of the first things I would love to see is that older injectables that are making one in four patients deaf, they should not be doled out by black and brown nations. The governments are currently doling out these very toxic injectables, which would not even get market approval today, only because the newer, more humane drugs are locked under patent.
And you're saying these older drugs are causing deafness in the people taking them?
Yes, and in the book I profile a patient who went deaf, and it's a very 25% of the patients go deaf. So one of the things that I'd immediately like to see is for the older drugs to be phased out, so safer, newer drugs can be used because this is a preventable, curable disease. We're just not giving the people the medicine that actually is. The second thing I would very much like to happen is have a larger conversation about intellectual property and how we cannot govern medicines the same way legally, the way we govern iPhones and refrigerators. Intellectual property laws affect everybody's lives, whether we know it or not. If you are in any part of the world, you've popped a pill. And if you've done that, your life is affected by how drugs are priced. And this has to be one global conversation as against a fragmented conversation of cancer patients fighting for their drugs and TB patients fighting for that. And I really hope what this book does is give everyone a common story to take forward, that the access to medicine is one global conversation.
Vidya Krishnan is author of Phantom Plague, How Tuberculosis Shaped History. She spoke to us from Goa, India. Vidya, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Catch up with the latest reporting by our correspondents around the globe, from the case of the disappearing giant Humboldt squid in Mexico to the story of one of China's last remaining lantern makers. And of course, the latest on the tensions between Ukraine and Russia. Find those and other stories on our website, theworld.org. You're listening to The World. Hi there, Marco here. At The World, our community connects people from all over the globe. This connection is evident by the 779 people who donated during The World's fall fundraising campaign. Here are just a few of those supporters. Luis Mallaret, Izaz Manzar, Kyoko Maruyama, Ben McCormick, James McClellan, Shelley Miller, Susan Nestler, Vaughn Nguyen, Chris and Catherine Olson, Lori Otto. These names represent a fraction of the vast community that helps keep the world free and accessible to all. From everybody at The World, thank you for your support. In Ghana, there are artists who create works for people's final resting place.
This is the home of fantasy coffins. If you want to have fun in the land of the dead, then you need to get your coffins here.
Want to get buried inside a lion? These artists have become intertwined with life and death in the capital, Accra. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Corporations are doing it, and so are countries, and now the European Union has set a goal of becoming carbon neutral. Its target, 2050. French President Emmanuel Macron says he's come up with a solution on how to get there. It is a nuclear renaissance, as he calls it. As Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris, not everyone in Europe is on board.
Speaking to a crowd of employees at a nuclear turbine factory in eastern France earlier this month, French President Emmanuel Macron said the government would invest around 50 billion euros in nuclear power, building up to 14 new reactors.
Ce que nous avons à bâtir aujourd'hui.
What we have to build today, because it is the right time, because it is what our country needs, because the conditions are there, is the rebirth of France's nuclear industry, Macron said. France has long been Europe's leading producer of atomic energy. Today, 70% of the country's electricity comes from nuclear. Macron's latest announcement isn't the first talk about a nuclear renaissance. At the turn of the millennium, scientists singled out nuclear energy as a virtually carbon-free and cost-effective technology that could be a powerful tool in the face of climate change.
But then there was Fukushima in 2011.
That's Nicola Mazzucci, an energy specialist at the Paris-based Foundation for Strategic Research. He explains that the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster, set off by an earthquake and tsunami, all but pushed nuclear's renaissance back into the dark ages.
That changed the way that nuclear was perceived in Europe, but also in the whole world. So there was a global stall in nuclear development.
Especially in neighboring Germany, which has pledged to close its last nuclear power plants by the end of this year. A dozen other EU countries still have operating nuclear reactors. Roger Spout is an anti-nuclear campaigner for Greenpeace.
The different accidents that happened in Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, have shown that there is always a risk of a major accident in a nuclear power plant.
Germany has instead turned its investments towards renewable energy sources like wind and solar power.
These are technologies which can be developed very quickly within a couple of years. Nuclear power plants, it takes at least 10 years to construct a new reactor, and the costs are much higher than the cost for example, offshore wind turbines.
But even if they're less expensive than building nuclear power plants, renewable energy sources come with their own set of problems. Because they depend on the nature of the sun and wind, their output can be unpredictable. In other words, you can't rely on renewables alone, says Nicolas Mazzucci.
A wind turbine is only producing electricity when you're having wind between 45 to 90 kilometers per hour. Nuclear power plant can produce electricity barely any time in any conditions.
That's why Mazzucci says Germany has found itself in a bit of a pickle and is now increasingly relying on coal and natural gas reserves from Russia to make up for the absence of nuclear energy sources. For Mazzucci, it's all about finding the right balance between renewables and nuclear, which is exactly what France is doing. Macron has also pledged to build at least 50 offshore wind farms and increase its solar capacity tenfold by 2030.
Nuclear is an important part of the solution. For example, when you look at the French electricity sector, we're having barely no greenhouse gases emission from the electricity production because we're having 70% nuclear and 25 to 28% renewables, mostly hydropower.
In January, the European Commission drew up plans to label nuclear and natural gas as, quote, green energies. Critics like Germany, Austria, and Luxembourg have attacked the Commission's proposal as an example of greenwashing. Meanwhile, new technologies such as nuclear fusion could provide a stable source of energy in the future. But for now, with the climate crisis intensifying, France says nuclear remains the best shot the EU has to achieve carbon neutrality by 2050. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
Speaking of consequential decisions around energy, in Iraq, the country's federal court this week ruled that a law allowing Iraqi Kurdistan to manage its own oil supplies is unconstitutional. Iraq's federal government has now demanded the Kurdistan regional government hand over control of its oil. With us to discuss the significance of this ruling is Ben Van Heuvelen. He's the editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report. He joins us from New York. So Iraqi Kurdistan-Banna is an autonomous region of Iraq. Explain how this arrangement had been working up until this court ruling this week. Like, the Kurds were able to manage their own oil supplies within Iraq?
To really understand it, you have to go all the way back to 2005 when Iraq passed its constitution. And the only way they could pass a constitution back then was by making it so vague that everyone could agree with it. And all of the parts of the constitution that talk about oil powers essentially say there's supposed to be some cooperation between the federal government and the regional authorities. This is supposed to be defined by an oil law. Now, the oil law has never been passed. The Kurdistan region passed its own regional oil law, which has been the legal basis for everything that it's done for the past 15 years or so. There's been this ongoing dispute over whether the Kurdistan region's oil law is constitutional or not. This is the first time that there's been an authoritative ruling on that question.
How reliant generally is Baghdad on Iraqi Kurdistan for oil?
The Baghdad government does not depend on Kurdistan for any of its own oil revenue. The federal government exports a tiny fraction of its oil through a pipeline that the Kurdistan region controls. The much bigger consequence this ruling is on the Kurdistan region itself, which depends on its independent oil revenues for the vast majority of the money that the government uses to run.
So why does the federal government in Iraq want those supplies back in their control? Is it purely a money issue?
I think by far the biggest concern the federal government has had is around the unity and coherence of the state. The subtext of Kurdistan's independent oil sector for over a decade has been the Kurdistan region's desire to become an independent country. And economic independence was a step on the road toward establishing political independence. Federal authorities in Baghdad have been nervous about that because there's no clean way to break up the Iraqi state into two parts.
What could this do to Iraqi Kurdish autonomy if the economic underpinnings to Iraqi Kurdistan are removed?
You know, the Kurdistan region has spent 15 years establishing facts on the ground, contracts with international companies, oil pipelines, agreements to govern those oil pipelines. So even though the federal court's decision says effective immediately, the federal government ought to have control over all of this, there's not any neat or clean or quick way to make that happen. So in the very short term, I think everyone's sort of in wait and see mode. In the slightly longer term, Iraq is in the process of choosing a new government, and this will be a huge mess for the next administration to sort out.
What has been the reaction so far from the Kurdistan regional government? What are they saying about this?
First, they vehemently disagree with the decision. They have a completely different interpretation of the constitution. The second thing that they've said, which is interesting, is they've acknowledged that any solution to the problems created by this ruling have to involve negotiations with Baghdad.
Ben Van Heuvelen is the editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report. He spoke with us from New York. Thank you very much, Ben.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Before COVID, Spain was one of the top tourist destinations in the world. Despite taking a serious hit during the pandemic, tourism in Spain today still accounts for roughly 13% of the country's GDP. One of the most popular destinations is Barcelona, and part of the reason why is due to Americans and a quirk of history. The World's Lucia Benavides reports from Barcelona.
In January 1951, the United States Sixth Fleet pulled up to the Barcelona port for the first time. 10,000 sailors disembarked and found a rather gray and poor city. At the time, Barcelona was still recovering from the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s.
This area, the Raval, which we're looking across there now, across the road there now, was one of the most heavily bombed of the war and was probably left in ruins as a punishment.
Nick Lloyd leads historical tours in downtown Barcelona. We're at the port, facing the city, where a controversial statue of Christopher Columbus points out at sea. Behind him is the famous pedestrian street, Las Ramblas, full of shops selling postcards and kitschy souvenirs. Lloyd says the touristy Barcelona we know of today is in large part a result of the 37 years the American Sixth Fleet spent stationed here.
Because the American Sixth Fleet, as well as being a military operation, was also functioning at least within the context of its stay in Barcelona as a little bit like a cruise ship.
They didn't come to be tourists. They came because the U.S. government had made a pact with Spain to use 7 of its ports. At the time, Spain was under the rule of fascist dictator Francisco Franco and geopolitically cut off from most of the world. Lloyd says this pact allowed Franco, who continued to torture and kill political dissidents, to stay in power for nearly 30 more years. But the arrival of the Sixth Fleet also brought an unexpected flow of cash to Barcelona's poorest neighborhoods, kicking off leisure and entertainment businesses built around the young men.
You know, they're bringing in the first Zippos, rock and roll records, jeans, and bringing in a sort of a whiff of modernity, perhaps, and ideas of freedom, which just didn't exist under the Franco regime.
To this day, the financial and cultural impact the U.S. Sixth Fleet had on Barcelona is fairly unknown to locals. Writer and journalist Xavier Teros did an in-depth investigation in 2010, which he turned into the only existing book on the topic, written in the regional language of Catalan.
Si no hubiera estado presente la Guerra Fría en aquel momento.
Teros says it was because of the Cold War and the supposed threat of communism that the U.S. made that deal with Franco, a fascist dictator who years earlier it had condemned. But the sailors themselves had no real political ties. Teros says there were young men in their late teens and early 20s who had left home for the first time.
Barcelona fue una fiesta.
It was like a party, he says. Barcelona welcomed them with open arms. For the sailors, who arrived with American dollars, Barcelona was dirt cheap, even considering the price hikes locals gave them. Teros says many sex workers were able to pay their way out of poverty by charging 6 times as much.
Las prostitutas barcelonesas fueron las primeras que por razones laborales aprendieron el inglés.
Barcelona's sex workers were the first to learn English, says Teros, by finding amateur teachers and holding classes in cafes. But over the decades, public opinion towards the sailors' presence changed. By the 1980s, with Franco dead and democracy installed, locals began to see them as a symbol of American imperialism and protested their stay. The Sixth Fleet left Barcelona for good after an attack on a sailor social club left one man dead and several injured.
Pasó de la fascinación y la maravilla a ser los malos de la película.
They went from being idolized to being the bad guys, Tero says. But they left behind a tourism industry that continued to grow in their absence. For the world, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
To Egyptians, the name of their capital is not Cairo, it's El Kahira. Likewise, Russians don't say Moscow, they say Moskva. Still, the similarities with the English names for those cities, it's pretty evident. When it comes to Bangkok, the Thai name is completely different. It's unknown to most foreigners, and Thailand's government wants to change that, hoping to phase out the English name, Bangkok, and get everyone to use the Thai name for the capital. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen in, all right, I'm just going to say, in Thailand.
Krung Thep. That's a name a lot of folks may need to start practicing. Diplomats, business people, news anchors, tourists, and so on. Krung Thep is what Thais call Bangkok, and it may soon become the official English name for the capital as well. That government proposal seemed to come out of nowhere this week, so I hit the streets of Bangkok to ask some locals what they think. Here's a Thai businessman who goes by the name Pitch.
I think it seems like the government didn't really consult anyone as well, so it just got announced, and I think everybody's surprised about it and amused, I would say.
Amused because the city's name, the city's actual full name, isn't just Krung Thep. Those are just the first 2 words in the longest city name in the world. Even Thai people struggle with it.
Do you know the full name of the city of Bangkok?
No, it's quite hard. Okay. But I know Krung Thep Mahanakhon, but I can't memorize the full name.
Actually, as the proposal stands, the city's official English name would be Krung Thep Mahanakhon, meaning the City of Angels, the Great City. That's still less than 10% of the full title, though. There are lots of jokes going around now about forcing foreigners to learn the whole name. I found a Bangkok taxi driver, Mr. Salakiet, who asked, why are we doing this? Won't foreigners just get confused? It's probably a bad idea, he says. Just stick with the current English name, Bangkok. Putting him on the spot, I also asked if he could recite the city's full name in Thai. I ask, but isn't there more? Yeah, there's more, he says, but I can't remember. Thai people who can recite the full name usually have to sing it. Here's the tune that everybody in Bangkok knows. This band is called Asani Wasan, and this track was a huge hit in the 80s. The lyrics are just the name of the city, and here's the full translation. City of Angels, Great City of Immortals, Magnificent City of the Nine Gems, Seat of the King, City of Royal Palaces, Home of Gods Incarnate, erected by the god Wisanukam at the god Indra's behest. Or if you're in a hurry, Gungtet. Bangkok, or Bangkok, is an old, old name for a part of the city visited by European traders centuries ago. It has a less grandiose meaning, village of wild plums. But for foreigners, Bangkok just stuck. So will the name change make Bangkok go away? Chris Hurst is a retiree from Britain living in Thailand for 26 years, and he doesn't think so.
I don't know why they would want to change it.
Yeah, so when you first saw the news, what did you think?
I just thought it's something which won't happen, actually.
Go on.
No, I just think everybody knows it as Bangkok, you know?
Meaning maybe international diplomats will start saying Gungtet Mahanakhon, and some signs might change around town. But most of the English-speaking world might just shrug and keep saying Bangkok. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, reporting from Gungtet Mahanakhon, Amon Ratanakosin, Mahin Tarayutia, Mahadilokpop, Noparat Rajatani Burirom, Udom Rachani Wed Mahasatan, Amon Piman Awatan Satit, Sakatatia Wisanukam Prasit, Thailand.
In Ghana, a group of artists have elevated the craft of coffin making. They make fantasy coffins in the shape of a favorite car, for example, or an animal the deceased person was fond of. Fantasy coffins are now featured in museums around the world, but in Ghana, they're an integral part of life and obviously death. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra takes us to the workshop of one maker of fantasy coffins.
A strong smell of fresh fish and firewood smoke fills the air, ushering me into Teshi, a fishing community in Ghana's capital, Accra. Along the street, I hear the sound from this carpentry workshop, situated right in the center of this six-room apartment. A group of eight men, sweating and stained in wood shavings, are busy at work. It is a grim job, one may argue, but someone has got to do it. Never mind the fact that they may be viewed as sadists, profiting from the loss of others. But 22-year-old Lawrence Annan says this is not his intention.
We, the coffin makers, have emotions too, like any other person. We do cry sometimes when someone passed away. But our work is really important, so we have to do our work.
Annan learned the trade from his dad, who also inherited it from his father. The family business started over 60 years ago, he says. At his shop is this amazing array of painted wood sculptures. For a moment, I think I'm in an artist's studio. Despite their seemingly over-the-top appearance, these indeed are functional coffins. What are you working on right now?
I'm working on a lion.
A lion coffin?
Yeah.
Who is requesting this?
That's a chief. A lion is the authority of in the forest. He's the authority in the community.
In Ghana, the fantasy coffin industry is not just about paying respect to the dead, but also a status symbol of the deceased, a statement to the life or occupation of the departed. This airplane coffin is for a pilot, then this truck-designed coffin for a driver, and a microphone-shaped coffin for a musician or a broadcaster like me.
We have something like a cocoa pot for a farmer, and then a Bible for a priest, and then a pen or a book for a teacher.
What is the weirdest request you've had?
That's a crocodile.
A crocodile?
Yeah, it was for a priest in the Volta region.
It takes 1 to 2 weeks to build a coffin, and so much goes into preparing it. First, it is measured. It has to be just the right fit, he says, but enough to leave some space around the corpse, what he ironically describes as breathing space. It is then put together and sandpapered for a smooth feel. Splinters must not injure those who handle it. Next, it is painted or sprayed. And then you have the finished product, a coffin ready for its occupants. That's Felicia Okine greeting in the Ghan language. She is here at the Kanekwe carpentry shop to place an order.
I really admire their works, and so I came here to get either the cocoa pod designed coffin or the palm fruit designed coffin for a relative who was a farmer. It will make the funeral the talk of town.
These coffins are not just at town funerals. For more than 5 decades, fantasy coffins have become one of Ghana's most unique cultural exports. Anan lists some international destinations for his coffins.
Mostly to the US, but we have a museum in Europe too. I have a senior brother in Wisconsin, also working on this.
These coffins, made from soft wood and mahogany, cost between $250 and $1,000. The shop produces up to 20 coffins each month.
This is the home of fantasy coffins. If it's not here, then it's nowhere. If you want to have fun in the land of the dead, then you need to get your coffins here.
Ghanaians find ways to celebrate even in the most morbid of circumstances. This funeral grounds in Accra is akin to a typical birthday party. People are seen dancing, whining and dining. The latest addition is a new trend for dancing pallbearers, which involves a troupe dressed in flamboyant outfits who fancifully wobble to music as they shoulder the coffin. Many business owners in Ghana pray daily for more clients for the success of their businesses. So, I sought to find out the coffin maker's prayer.
My prayer is for work to be brought to us, and then God should protect us from injuries.
You don't pray for people to die?
No, never.
Because a lot of people think you actually pray for people to die.
Wow. A human being will die, will definitely die. And when you die, you'll be buried.
For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Mystic future in Tyler Loyal.
That's right.
Alongside Sizzler Colonel.
We began the week with some nasty weather in Boston, the kind of wintry mix that prompted one Jamaican emigre to the area to write a song about missing home.
Lost in a foreign land, far from Jamaica.
This is the latest single from Kevin Mark Holness, aka Mighty Mystic. If the name Holness sounds familiar, Kevin is the younger brother of Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness. So when Kevin, or rather Mighty Mystic, sings Far From Jamaica, you know he's missing a lot. Mighty Mystic came to Boston from Jamaica with his family when he was 9. Even though he's a local, now in his 40s, Mighty Mystic, like so many of us who live in the snowy parts of this country, he's just done with it by February. Far enough out from the first snow when the fluffy stuff is no longer a novelty. It's just a pain. Far From Jamaica, though, isn't just about missing home.
9 to 5, 5 to 9, working all the time. 10,000 miles away, far from Jamaica.
The song is also about what it's like to be yoked to a faster pace of life in a different country. Pressures around making money, when maybe slower and less hectic is what we all really yearn for. It is the weekend, so ruminate on that for the next 48 hours as you exhale.
We're only working to fill their pockets. Don't be a slave to the system, you need to stop it.
bracket. Bread to this racism, I bust all in the bracket. I just need to be free and that's it.
Gotta get out from here, far from here.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, online 24/7 at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong, have a relaxing couple of days, and we'll see you right back here on Monday.
Working all the time, 10,000 miles.